This is Donald Smith. It's June the 11th, 2010, during reunion at Cornell University. Dr. Lynn Comans, class of 1960, is here to share her stories about becoming a veterinarian and her life as one. Thank you very much, Lynn, for joining us.
You're more than welcome. I believe my journey here started, of course, as a child. I was raised in Cattaraugus County, which is in western New York State.
Where did you grow up in Cattaraugus?
What town? Randolph, New York. Not an area of great economic or intellectual burgeoning, as I recall, or I think is today. But my parents were quite progressive. My father had been in medical school, pre-med, but had to come home because of economic difficulties. He was a medic in the Second World War, and he thought very highly of the healing professions. My mother, and for those days it was quite unusual, had actually gone to a training school and was a dental hygienist. So they, from the beginning, never spoke of if you go to college, it was always when you go to college. And there was no question that we would go to college. One of the earlier experiences I had was in the fifth grade. I had a nun, Sister Mary Angelina, a woman of strong opinions and rigid pointers, and she asked us to write a paper on what we would be when we grew up, and it had to be illustrated. I could only draw Cocker Spaniel and horse heads. Therefore, I said, I would like to be a veterinarian. They looked at the paper and said, well, you can't do that. Women can't do that. And the gauntlet was down. From there on, it was just, that's what I'm going to do. In high school, we had a teacher of ag in the high school. Of course, women were not allowed to take that either. But I did interview with him. His name was Matthew Escoli. And he did not encourage me. But what he said was, Cornell is a fair and honest place. If you belong there, they'll accept you. And I took that and I ran with it. I went to a French convent school for 2 years to prep. It was a great liberal arts education, and they were very anxious. Sister Superior was very anxious that one of their students should go to Cornell. So they accommodated me with physical chemistry, physics, in place of maybe history of the church or some of those other courses. My marks were good. And I took my preliminary exam in a snowstorm in Buffalo, and then came up here for an interview.
So your undergrad was where then?
D'Youville College. At that point, it was a French convent boarding school. D'Youville. It's in Buffalo.
Perfect.
They had a strong nursing course, and my mother wanted me toned down a little bit. I think she wanted me to have a liberal arts education.
How would you compare that education with your classmates who had 2 years of agriculture?
I think I benefited. I had both the liberal arts and the specific education. Mm-hmm. My interview day was quite interesting. A classmate of mine, Steve Dye, preceded me into the interview wearing his FFA jacket, which he still has. Then it was my turn, and I came in, and there was an array of gentlemen. Dr. Danks was there for sure. I think Dr. Brenner was there, but I'm not 100% sure of that. I know Dr. Danks was the primary questioner. And I was sitting there in my great pride, and I had on a dress I had made myself. And in those days, animal feed came in patterned cotton bags, and you could take those bags and make something. A potholder may have been more appropriate, but I made a dress. And so I was sitting there so proudly in my handmade dress, and Dr. Danks said, did you make that dress? Yes, I did. And he said, did you make it out of a feed sack? I said, yes, I did. And I got in. I don't know if he was appalled by those answers or pleased by those answers, but I was accepted into the school. And I can remember coming down from Olean, down the west side of the lake, and my father pointing across at the bell tower and saying, that's your future. In those days, it's hard to remember that I couldn't have gone to another school that was outstanding. Only Cornell took women. Notre Dame didn't, Princeton didn't, the teachers' colleges did, the women's colleges did, the Catholic women's colleges did, but I could not have gone to another school of quality, only this one. I started here as a freshman. In the freshman dorms, we had to live on campus for 2 years, the women's students did. I lived in what were then the Circle dorms, which were houses that there's now a cyclotron there, and we could eat in Balch.
I used to take great pride in the fact that the three of us, the three women veterinarians at Aiken Balch, we had our own table. Well, who would want to sit with the smelly people like us? You know, I mean, we just come out of the... Yeah. Took me a while to catch on that it was, that we were important. It was that we smelled bad. And we had to be on the meal plan. They eventually let us include Martha Van and or the Dairy Barn in our breakfast meal plan. Because it's hard to get all the way over to Balch and all the way up here. It's a gallop. That year was the last year in the old school. So we were the last class in the old school. It was an interesting building because there were no facilities for women, quote, bathrooms. So we would have to either go over to the hotel school, where they certainly didn't want us to come in our anatomy clothes, or we could go upstairs to the secretary's bathroom, which was just a stall. There was nothing. They didn't want us in there in our anatomy clothes. Sometimes somebody would stand guard at the men's room, and we'd all run in there. And then, of course, he'd stop standing guard, and everybody would laugh. That was the funniest thing ever. When we moved to the new school, my big thrill was there were women's bathrooms all over the place. But it was a good year. I learned a lot. It was the first time I really had to work at my academics. I did not come out high that year. Moving up to the new school, we had to cut the class, I think, by 14 students. If they had cut it by 15, I think I would have gone. But there were 14 of my classmates that left that year at the low end of the, and some of them did come back. The fourth girl in our class left that year to marry her husband, who was in the Army. The other three of us stayed through the 4 years and were and still are very good friends. The new school was a longer walk, but it certainly was a phenomena. And as the first class in there, you know, we were pretty hot stuff wandering around these halls and looking at all the buildings. I remember my professors well. I remember Dr. Evans from the old school. As we were coming in for an interview, he said, "Would you like to see my tropical fish collection?" And we said, "Oh, yes." And he took out a jar and poured them out in his hand. That wasn't what I was thinking about. Dr. Brunner was a fine gentleman, a great person to be around. Dr. Danks, Dr. Fisher, Dr. Fox, certainly, who was an outstanding teacher. I liked poison plants a lot because I like plants and I like being outdoors. I'll have to admit I had cut one or two anatomy labs to go on Dr. Rockcastle's natural history tours out around the countryside. But it took me, I would say, 2 years to acclimate. And then also we moved into the practical phase. My marks began to come around and I began to absorb the things I should have absorbed instead of just the phenomena of being at this big school. I'm missing two fingers on my right hand. And that was happened when I was 18 months old. Under some circumstances, I think that might have been considered a problem. But because it happened when I was so young, it never was. I did well with my practical courses. I didn't do badly in my academic courses, but I don't think I was an outstanding academic student. I had difficulty passing the boards. It took me three tries to finally get the boards, but I got them. My classmates were, for the most part, very nice people. You know, they give you a hard time every once and again. But I would also say, as a woman at that point, we didn't expect anything different. We expected to be shuffled aside, and maybe not sometimes in the manner that we were, but we were just so grateful to be here. We didn't think to be defiant. We didn't think to call in the Civil Liberties Union or anything like that. We just thought, keep your nose to the grindstone and get it done. You're here. And I think our classmates began to respect us for that, because I would say when I graduated, most of my classmates thought dearly of me. I dated some of them. On an occasional fraternity party, I was even engaged 12 hours for a couple of them, but they were brief engagements. My personal experiences with the professors were mostly good. Dr. Miller's wife was involved with the 4-H Club, and I was involved with the 4-H Club in Brooktondale. And I was at their house a few times for 4-H commotions. I went to polo parties at Dr. Roberts' house that he had for the polo club. And Dr. Roberts used to keep the liquor under the manger in one of the stalls. And if you weren't drunk enough to get by the horse, you could pick up whatever you wanted. But if the horse wasn't going to let you get by, you were done for the evening. So I was at a couple of those polo parties. We had a lot of fun on weekends. My roommate and I, who was a classmate, Sue Goddard, we lived together in an apartment that backed up to Alpha Psi. We were allowed to use their washing machine. We went in to use their washing machine one time, and there was all this grease, and there was lettuce in the washing machine. Bob Femister, who was in charge of the dinners in there, made toss salad in the washing machine. He turned it on. So we went in to use it. It was all full of oil and lettuce.
But we had lots of fun, and they were very good to us. I didn't interact closely, I don't think any of the women did, with the professors. There were a few ugly incidents, but most of the time, they just more or less ignored us. Dr. Roberts was very good on ambulatory. I actually did a couple of ambulatory calls all by myself. He trusted me both to drive the vehicle and to give a cow a shot of penicillin. I think that trust was well placed. Other ambulatory people would say, quite frankly, no girls or Jews in my car, and we didn't go. They wouldn't have us. But I wasn't terribly upset. I realized it was improper. I realized it was wrong for that to happen. But I wasn't terribly upset. I thought I'd be fine without that, and indeed I was. So I graduated. We had a nice graduation day. It was sunny. It was nice. My parents were proud. I was happy. I went to work in Buffalo in a small animal practice. And the week before I was to come in, that man suffered a major heart attack. So I went into a practice all by myself. And that's when I learned to love staff. And if I was going to tell any practitioner anything, love your staff, because they guided me through this. And he also had a pharmacy with maybe 150 brown apothecary bottles that said things on them like Joe's Formula, number 2 tonic. And there was heart tonic from Pittman Moore. That was the only one I recognized. And they guided me through that. He was back in about a month, and it was a quite basic practice. After I graduated, they were starting to get specialty groups together, and they wanted me to be in and perhaps the president of the Women's Veterinary Association. And I highly disapproved of that, because I don't think that you should be separated on your accident of birth. I don't think there should be a white-skinned veterinary organization or a gray-eyed veterinary organization or a male veterinary or a female, because those are accidents of birth, and I don't think they should be a designation of yourself. So I didn't want to do it, and I objected strongly to it. And it's an organization that maybe at that time it had value. I don't think it's maintained itself very well, but I don't think it's maintained itself as a power. The man that I ended up marrying from the class of 59 had a job with the New York State Racing Commission. So we got married in 61. I moved to Long Island, established a practice on Long Island, which we ran for about 42 years. We were very, very lucky. We came into the golden age of veterinary medicine. We were well-trained. We came into it when it was on the upswing, when veterinarians were loved and respected members of the community, and they should have been. I have 4 kids. I have 3 adopted children and 1 genetic child. And my husband and I, we raised them all. There's the saying, you can't have everything. Dr. Petey said a very wise thing, you can't have it all at one time. But what I would say is you can't have everything, and my choice was not to have a clean house. The kids have all had a college education. They're all pursuing something in their lives. And they were a great joy, a great joy. I just cannot say enough about my family life, which was a wonderful blessing. You know, it sustained me many times when I was ready to just, phooey on this whole thing. And the other way around, my professional life sustained me with my family life. Again, I was just yin and yang, very, very fortunate. There's nothing but good fortune in my life, really. I've been very lucky. And I loved being a veterinarian. I loved practicing. I'm not going to say every single morning I was happy to get up and go to work, but overall, I just loved it. It was different every day. It was creative. It was exciting. We got involved in the American Animal Hospital Association, which at that point was innovative and creative. It was not primarily business practice. And we learned a lot of things through them. I got involved in avian work. Dr. Altman had the largest avian practice. He graduated from Pennsylvania. And I had probably the second largest, had a large avian practice. That was before there was boards. By the time the boards came around, I was not up to that level of writing papers and so on. So I was never boarded. It was only a special interest.
I'm curious, could you explain a bit more about how you got into avian work?
Well, because my father was a chicken farmer. How I got in was, I had a client on Long Island who had Boston Bulldogs. He asked me if I'd ever done anything with pigeons. And I also had graduated with, in my mind, I had a duty to all animals. So he said, did I ever do anything with pigeons? And I said, well, I've done a lot with poultry. I could take a look. And when you start out with a species, basically, it's all husbandry. And it works up from there. So he began to bring me his racing pigeons.
This would be around 1970 or 75?
I'm going to guess 70. So I began to work with the racing pigeons, and because it was of interest to me, I charged him very little. His racing pigeons began to do very well, and he kept bringing them back.
What were you treating them for?
Mainly, I was treating them from coccidiosis. Anything and telling them not to put 400 in one coop. That was the major thing I was doing. And I got poultry water for him, sulfas. And his pigeons began to do well, and I was very happy for the dear old man until I found out they were betting tens of thousands of dollars on these pigeons. Now, I was missing a lot. Finally, one time he said to me, "You know, you've done good for me." He says, "I'm Siciliano. Anytime you want anything, let me know. One leg or two." And I went, "Oh my God, what am I doing? What am I doing?" You know? So that's how I kind of got into it. And then I would go to AHA meetings, and they'd have one of the first avian things I ever went to. We took bird seed, and we were counting how many millet seed, how many this, how many that. And it was working on nutrition. Through avian work, I got really interested in cellular diagnosis. I think a microscope next to your hands is, I like it better than a stethoscope. Because of the avian work, I did quite a bit of, I would call it cellular diagnosis. But you're talking about innovative stuff. I saw filarias long before heartworm was showing up. I would see these filarias in cockatoos, in the blood. Once the law went through that we had to breed them instead of import them, I started to stop seeing a lot of that stuff. But I learned to sex birds by going in with a light. And I learned that from knowing how to caponize chickens as a kid. So I found it interesting. I've always liked something else. So that's probably why I got into avian works, probably why I got into acupuncture. I did a few snakes back in those days. I used to do some gerbils and some hamsters, but they're going to die next year no matter what you do. So you explain to the people, these guys are supposed to have a short line. They're supposed to live a couple of years, reproduce, and get eaten by something else. So don't expect an awful lot. I can stop him from itching, but he's probably not going to make it much past the next year. But I always like to do something else. So that was fun. I enjoyed it a lot. We sold the practice in 2001, and I went to Florida, and I was bored out of my mind. So I got involved in acupuncture, which was being taught up in Gainesville. I've now got a small acupuncture practice, and I do per diem work in the Central Florida area. And so I'm still practicing. I'm still doing what I love. I'm just so lucky because I've maintained good health, moderate mental ability, and had opportunity just laid out in front of me. And Cornell gets, I could have been a secretary, a teacher, maybe an MD, but I got to be a veterinarian. You know, it's great. Be your best. Be your best. You can't do it every day, but every day that you can, just be your best. Whatever your level is, do it to your very best ability and be proud. That's the story.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.